Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, extending maternal care beyond 6 weeks. Meet the woman who's taking that into the community and beyond. How to navigate disrupted sleep with Tom Coleman. And what's the story with creatine with performance nutritionist Daniel Davey. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I have been good. I do think it's bonkers when people, and we love it in this country, are like, where has the year gone? But it is flying, isn't it? I don't really want to alarm you, but I was in the post office recently and the lady behind the counter, through the various chat, I had come to know that she was getting married soon. And I was asking her when the countdown is. And she said a date in October and mentioned it being 6 weeks away. And that gave me a bit of a judder. So I thought I would share that jolt with you. And I do always say we should embrace the seasons. And as we are nature, we're supposed to go with nature. And I will 100% welcome the golden autumn leaves. And I absolutely adore Halloween. So I will be taking autumn on with open arms. But let this be a warning to you. Get onto the beach for a walk in the evening. Get into the sea for a dip if that's your thing. Have your friends over for a barbecue. Get the garden sorted. Whatever was on your list to do this summer, get it done. And let's all soak up the last of the summer wine. And I was doing that with absolute abandon at Altogether Now. My first breathwork session at a festival. I was on the Go Loud stage in the Go Loud lounge. So yeah, it was a great experience. Something I don't think I thought I would ever say I did. And now it is done. Thank you so much to everyone who came along. It was an ask. At 12 p.m. on Sunday, after a weekend of partying for the festival goers, but hopefully that session of breathwork was the refuel people needed to go again on the last day. And I feel like it's been a summer of yes for me. My hubby and I have embraced all social invitations that have come our way. And I have to say, I'd recommend it. It was good for the soul. You can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, whether you're finishing a night shift at the hospital or driving home from a midnight food delivery run, disrupted sleep is more than just a personal challenge. It's a public health issue. This morning, we're diving into the hidden toll of sleepless nights with sleep expert Tom Coleman. Tom, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on, Claire.
This is an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, anyone that's worked shift, I certainly did the breakfast shift for a long time, and it can be hugely debilitating. So as humans, are we designed, is our circadian rhythm designed that we would sleep through the night only?
It's a really good question. There's a lot of theories on it. I mean, like, we are diurnal creatures. We're not nocturnal. So if we are working nights, it's contra to our circadian rhythm. Okay. Now, within our circadian rhythm, there are certain people who are very early birds. And then there's people who are, you know, normal, waking up at a normal time, going to bed before midnight. And then there's people who are night owls, and there's a whole host of different within the species. So as a group, it would be advantageous for certain people to be up very early and other people to be up very late. And that's known as your chronotype. So there is some leeway there, but really, essentially, we're not designed to be working during the night and sleeping during the day. It's contrary to our biology.
And what are those different chronotypes? How would people recognise who they are? Or is it just based on how you feel in your waking hours?
I mean, you could clinically test it in terms of melatonin release. But I mean, for people to sort of figure that out, I think many people kind of know, are they a morning person or are they a night owl? It's about 30 40 30, and you find the sweet spot for you in terms of going to bed and, you know, the amount of sleep you require. Some people are just no good in the afternoon, evening. Other people kind of get the second wind, you know. So most of us kind of know what our chronotype is. And, you know, we plan our lives around that. We should be able to. But I suppose the working life is kind of more directed towards early birds, our societal clocks and demands that we have set up. It's kind of more suited to morning people.
Yeah, that 9 to 5, I know not everybody works those hours, but that's sort of the majority. And that means people are getting up early, they're sort of sitting at desks or whatever the job is at 9, then they're stopping for lunch. And is that slump in the afternoon, is that quite normal? How can we mitigate that? Yeah. Because I know some companies are starting to bring in sleep pods, but it's not necessarily the norm, is it?
It's not the norm. Now, we have slumps in our circadian rhythm. It's kind of dips in energy. And it's just how our biology works. The morning time, cortisol levels are at their highest. So it's a really good time to get to, you know, deal with stressful events and get things done. So like working with our biology, tackle the hardest task first when it comes to work. Work in bouts of 90 minutes. We know we sleep in 90 minutes. These are called ultradian cycles. The brain works in ultradian cycles during the day. So you're much better off to work in pulses. So again, we're working with our biology. There's natural dips then where we just take a little step back and we change it up. And I would kind of say to people, learn how to surf that wave. Don't be constantly looking for how can I beat this slump and how can I push through? You know, I mean, as a social group, you know, we should be actually getting together and taking it easy in the afternoons and evenings. You know, the day or waking hours is kind of split up into two phases. The active phase, the first 8 hours, and then the passive phase, the second 8 hours. So really, I mean, that's how our biology works. You know, the 9-to-5ers, fine. The shift workers, on the other hand, highly, highly disruptive. And I would say our society is built on the back of shift workers. We have to give them much more appreciation.
So let's talk about that shift worker then. I mean, for some people, it's a constant. It's a set time, like, you know, the breakfast shows I worked on. It's the same time every morning indefinitely. If you look at the likes of Ian Dempsey, he's been working that shift, you know, for 35 years. But for other people, it's different 1 week to the next week, and you're one mm-hmm. week on lates and then you're 1 week on earlies. Is there any way to try and get a handle on that? And what are the health implications for shift workers?
So there are health implications. To be mindful, it is a modifiable risk factor. And I say this to people that go, no, I can't, I have to work shifts. And look, you have a choice, you mightn't like it. I say to shift workers, your choices outside of work have more of an implication in terms of health protective behaviours and health risk behaviours. So for the shift worker, I suppose the issue is if it's constantly changing, 2 days, 2 nights, 4 days off, it's a very common shift within the police force, within nursing and things like that. The challenge is that there's nothing set in place. And the advice for shift workers is completely different to the advice for 9-to-5ers when it comes to sleep and nutrition and so on and so forth. You're constantly having to battle your body trying to realign and adapt, because we have a 24-hour master orchestrator timer. Now, all of the systems, like your digestive system and cardiovascular and all these systems, have independent timers, and they're all misaligned. And so when we're trying to work, we feel exhausted, tired, and we're going home then, and we're trying to sleep, even though we're wrecked, we cannot sleep. So it is a challenge. Now, if you're on a set shift, like Mr. Dempsey there, fair play to him for all those years, then that is, you can adapt to that to some degree, or you can set your life up around that and it doesn't change, because the brain likes that thing of set routines. But for the shift worker then, that this is where the challenge happens. So we try and help the body and brain realign. We use light. It's the main lever when it comes to changing your circadian rhythm. And you look at your shift pattern and you figure out when is the best time to eat. So, you know, there are good times to eat if you're on nights, and there are times that you should avoid food. Dr. Claire Corish, I've done a podcast with her recently around this, and she's published information on this. So, like, there is information there. Nap, learn how to nap, learn how to switch off, plan your sleep in cycles of 90 minutes. You know, all of this stuff you have to try and adapt and learn. But you won't really... You know, we're not designed to be like that. So it is a challenge. And I've done it myself. I've worked in a hospital. So I know, and I've done nights and early shifts and late shifts. And it's the constant change that our bodies are struggling to keep up with. So then your time off and your unwind and your restoration time and relaxation time are of paramount importance. Because if you don't, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, I definitely ate more when I was doing shift work, because my body was constantly seeking to be propped up. Not to mention I was having something to eat before my shift started, then something to eat after, then a lunch, then a dinner, you know, so that was just an extra meal going in almost, but your body would need it. And I definitely got ill more. My immune system was 100% compromised because there was days I could nap, there was days I couldn't with whatever else was going on work-wise or family-wise. So yeah, you can feel the stress on the body for sure. Is this something we should be talking about it more and pushing for policy change around this? I know in the transport industry, they've done a huge amount of work into making sure the drivers are only working for a certain amount of time because they recognise that that is a safety and health issue, not only for the driver, but for the people that they're transporting. Should we be doing this for all health workers to stop all this 2 days on, 4 days off, one late, one early, to help people become Ian Dempsey as best they can?
Why not? I really believe that we should talk about it more. We take it for granted. The 9-to-5ers don't have a clue that, you know, every piece of equipment in a hospital, every drug in a hospital, and everybody who works in a hospital, all shift workers are created by shift workers. All our police force are shift workers. All our hotel workers are shift workers. There's people getting up in the middle of the night, or, you know, at 11 o'clock at night when you're going to bed to drive a delivery truck to deliver your fresh croissants that you demand for your coffee in the morning, right? All of this stuff is, you know, it's our society. Is unfortunately now a 24/7 society, so we should be looking at shift patterns, not non-disruptive shift patterns that are better than some of the ones that I've kind of seen out there now, because the disruptions are going to occur, like you spoke about. Your ghrelin level, the hunger hormone, is much higher. It's higher in night shift workers, so they get cravings. And then immunity, well, you make immune cells while you sleep and you restock, so that's not happening as much as it should be. So there's a consequence to all of this. There's a medium and long-term consequence to this. But, you know, we should be giving them support, and that should come from the bottom down and from the top down as well, from policy. And, you know, looking at doing an analysis of different shift patterns and finding out which ones work best without having, you know, without money being the bottom line all the time.
Well, if you want to find out more about Tom's work or listen to that podcast that he mentioned there about the research around shift work, you can go to tomcoleman.ie, sleep expert. Tom Coleman, thank you so much for coming on. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Emer Daly of Daily Wellbeing is back with her latest in health and wellness stories. You're very welcome, Emer. And we're having a focus on festival season. We're all still buzzing here in Bower and News Talk about All Together Now and the Go Loud Lounge, and we still have Body and Soul and Electric Picnic to come. So you're going to share a few stories that can help people.
Exactly. One of my first stories is how many drinks can make a hangover kick in. So according to Dr. Bhavanisha Shah, she has shared that around 8 units is that danger zone for a hangover. And for a lot of people listening, they might not know what 8 units is. So 8 units is 4 pints of cider or beer, or 4 regular glasses of wine, or if you're drinking vodka at a festival, that's about 6 vodkas. And it might sound like a lot of drink, or it might sound like not a lot of drink to people, but that's around the point where you're going to be impacting your sleep, your vision, your coordination, and the next day you could be looking at hangover town. So just being mindful of how much you're drinking at a festival, I know it's probably the last thing you want to be thinking of, but just even saying to yourself, you know what, maybe I will get a 0.0, or how can you work on the next day? And so Dr. Bhavanisha has shared a few things that you can do so you don't get overwhelmed as well. If you're sleeping in a tent, make sure that you get a lot of sleep. Set yourself up nice and comfortably. Bring a pillow down with you. What do you need to get a good night's sleep? Hydrate as much as you can throughout the day. Bring down those electrolytes. I'm sure when you take them out, everybody's going to say, can I have one? And eat balanced foods. There might not be great options. Actually, today, festivals, the food element seems to be a huge part of it. But grab yourself some chips or some bread, something before you head back to your tent. And that can really save you in the morning.
I mean, everyone needs to have fun, but it's just good to know, because there's nothing worse, I'd imagine, than waking up in a hot tent hungover. So if a few of those tips can help with that, so you can go again.
Exactly.
You know, thank you very much for that. You are going to Electric Picnic. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I will be going to Electric Picnic with my lovely horse Rescue. They're a rescue centre for all animals across Ireland. And myself and my sister Niamh will be doing doga with them in the morning time at Electric Picnic. So we'll be doing a yoga class surrounded by lovely rescue animals that are there to maybe give you some extra TLC in the morning and get the energy flowing as well through a nice energizing morning yoga class.
Fab. Tell us a little bit about the endometriosis education program that's going to be rolled out in Irish schools. This is good news because currently it takes 9 years for somebody to get a diagnosis, and often women don't know about it because they weren't educated.
I know. I think this is a huge story that is such a positive impact for female health in Ireland. So the MISHA programme, which stands for Menstrual Information Specialising in Endometriosis, has already reached over 1,700 students in 14 schools across Ireland. And just to really break it down to people, that endometriosis affects 1 in 10 females in Ireland. So that is a huge amount. And by educating young adults at the stage that they are in school with credible information and really breaking it down for them to be easy to digest so that they know the information that they need if they feel the symptoms of endometriosis coming on, or if they have a friend who they could give that information to as well.
And that really important point that painful periods are not normal. Quite often it is normalized and it's just part of being a woman. Mm-hmm. But mild cramping, yes. Very painful periods, no. And it's well worth having the factual information. It might not necessarily be endometriosis, but even just having that in our general conversation in our schools will make a massive difference. Emer Daly, thanks as ever.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, when it comes to performance nutrition, there is a lot of noise, but only a handful of supplements actually stand up to scientific scrutiny. So is creatine the secret weapon for your gym bag, or is it just more hype? Joining us is Daniel Davey, performance nutritionist. Daniel, you're very welcome.
Thank you, as always.
The voice of reason in this. It is getting a lot of hype. Protein was getting a lot of hype. Now we seem to have moved to creatine. Where do you stand when it comes to the noise around supplementation?
Okay, so that's different to creatine. I suppose the noise around supplementation has always been there and will always be there because of the opportunity to make an awful lot of money. I mean, we're talking about a multi-billion euro dollar industry. So people, naturally, it's just human nature, will look for ways to benefit their health or performance with the least amount of effort. That is just unfortunately the way it is. So, and the industry responds with giving plenty of options.
And I think it's worth people knowing that a lot of the supplement industry, rather shockingly, is not certified. So people can put things on bottles, make all kinds of claims. You need to be really careful where you're taking your nutrition and supplement advice from.
Yeah, we're actually in Ireland, there are some pretty strong standards and legislation around what you can say around products, but it's more products that come in from outside of Ireland and maybe that aren't produced here. So you're right. And evidence it will go out the window with a lot of products. It's like what will catch people's attention rather than where the strength of the evidence lies. And I actually started my career working in this space, and there's a whole thing around label claim and putting in as many things in here that might catch people's attention. Like that's where the whole thing had started. But even something that might have some evidence for benefit is put in at a micro level. So that's a very common thing that you'll see. I mean, a very simple one to refer to here is like the levels of EPA, DHA, which is in omega-3, for example. You can have products sold and it mightn't even have a third of what's needed to be beneficial. So it does that kind of thing. That's very common in the supplement industry as well.
Yeah, and that's why you hear about very expensive pee.
Yes.
It's not doing anything to your body, but...
Yes.
Yes. Anyway, let's deal with creatine because it is one of the most well-researched sports supplements. So who is it for?
Well, I think that initially it was for people who trained at a certain level, who were looking for performance benefits, people who wanted to build strength, who wanted to improve performance on multiple levels. So it was often viewed as something that athletes would take. They've got high training demands, high volumes, and they want to do, ultimately, they want to do more work. They want to be able to add more volume to their training. And creatine works in very simple way. In a very simple way, creatine works by helping to produce more energy. So it's the explosive type of movements that you would see in sprinting or in the gym. So where there's a lot of those fast reps, what creatine does is provide the body with the ability to produce more ATP or energy for those reps. So it's just about the volume. It's about being able to do more. So it started with it being an athlete-focused supplement.
So when we hear the word athlete, I mean, I think of somebody at professional level or going to the Olympics. But if you are training for a marathon or you go to CrossFit or High Rocks or the gym on a regular basis, should you consider yourself to be an athlete?
I think it's important to know that where creatine would have been relevant would have been in, so, repeated sprint or performances, or athletes or people who were participating in high intensity, repeated bouts of high intensity exercise, which wouldn't have included something like marathon. But this is where the kind of the evolution of this, it is that there are a huge number of people now who are participating in sport recreationally in their own mind, but they're actually performing at levels that could be considered in the space of what would you would define as an athlete, like you've described, things like High Rocks. Now we have marathon and different races that would have been, again, traditionally social, but is demanding a huge amount of our bodies. So linking back to creatine, the potential benefits of creatine are suggested now to be outside of just those people who are, I suppose, involved or participating in those high intensity exercise sessions. So there's now there's the potential for it to benefit the retention of muscle, retention of strength, and it's been linked an awful lot more even to people who are active, but also looking to, as they age, maintain strength, function, muscle, and overall health.
I have also read a few articles linking creatine to brain health, cognition, mm-hmm. and mood. What's the latest research around that?
So, yeah, it is emerging. And even when I knew I was going to be on the call, I did a little bit of reading myself. And there is some research to suggest that it may help to enhance brain cognition or brain function, enhance memory. And it is in the, it's under fatigue. So it's where maybe there's sleep deprivation, or where people are feeling like they're under a lot of physical or mental stress, where creatine potentially has the ability to bring that little bit more clarity or help with memory. It is very early stages within research, but it is promising. And it is suggested that creatine may act like a buffer, or it may act as something whereby the brain is under stress. Like, a, you know, if you think about any machine or any active part of the body, it's under fatigue, it's under stress. And creatine, again, through that same mechanism, is helping to provide it with energy, so ATP, and that allows for better stability within the brain, enhancing its function.
So it's interesting. It seems that there is emerging science around it being beneficial, be you active or not, even though obviously the more active you are, the better your health in the long term. But if you are somebody who is very active and very much into their fitness, when you're taking it, how should you feel? How will you know it's working or benefiting you?
Well, that's the big question. And I think just to take maybe a step back for a moment, if you were to ask me about somebody saying, well, you know, I'm considering taking creatine, well, I'll still ask all of the same questions. I'll still go through your nutrition. I will still look at your energy intake, your carbohydrate intake, the amount of healthy fat and fiber, and your overall holistic approach to your nutrition. So are you getting enough sleep? Are you participating in exercise at levels that are recommended for you, based on your goals? So you work through all of these variables that matter most. And the bottom line, Claire, and you and I have talked about this a lot, is that most people aren't even meeting the recommendations for the pillars of health. So then people are really interested in shortcuts, and creatine has all of this evidence and there's all this exciting information about it, which is super. So I don't want to downplay the promising research, but we know that it is always going to be the fundamentals that have the biggest impact on our health. If you're doing all of those and you are exercising and you're looking to add creatine, there's very little downsides. And I know that's what will be the thing that people take away from this. Will you know it's benefiting you? If you are training and you've got a baseline fitness, let's say it is in strength or it is in that kind of those higher intensity levels, it's very easy to measure. Yeah, I mean, you'll feel like your recovery is better and you're able to increase the intensity of volume of work that you're doing. Will you notice the difference day to day in energy or brain function? Very, very hard to know.
I think it's such an important point that with any supplement, it's supplementing a healthy lifestyle. It's an add-on. So nutrition and lifestyle first. There isn't a magic pill. Not yet. And what about young people under the age of 18? We've got a lot more interest in health, in fitness, in bodybuilding. Should under 18s be taking it?
Well, any, I guess anybody who works in this space will know that adolescents or youth athletes anybody in that are interested in their health, no matter how much information that they've absorbed or whatever skill level that they're at, there's next to no youth athletes that need to be focusing on things like creatine at that stage of development. It is so important to nurture the right type of relationship with food and nutrition and to have all of those really fundamental skills in place. And then as your understanding and then as your experience improves, then you can consider these type of things. But we're talking about children. Do they need creatine? Absolutely not. Now, I think it's important to say that there's no negative, to date, there's no negative side effects that come from creatine consumption taken at the recommended dosage. I think that's really important. It is in the case where people exceed that sometimes you can have water retention and maybe some digestive issues, but that does not mean that you've got a green light to go and take it. I mean, that's the bottom line here. You've got so much work to do on your overall health before you consider any supplement.
And creatine is already found in foods like beef, pork, fish. So,
yes.
You know, making sure that you're hitting your protein goals, that should be sufficient.
Exactly. And that will cover the vast majority of your needs. So taking creatine just saturates your muscle with creatine with a little bit more. But you're absolutely right. Like fish and meat are some of the best sources. And that's why a lot of vegetarians and maybe people who don't consume an awful lot of animal protein products tend to find greater benefits from creatine, or it's a little bit more noticeable.
And women as much as men, I do feel like there's sometimes a shortfall in this, that when we think about supplementation, something like creatine, I know anecdotally that there are women who think that's for men, that's for bodybuilders, but we all need lean muscle mass for our long-term health.
Yeah, we do. And it was very, very interesting. I don't know if you saw it or not, but there was a young woman, she's a personal trainer, came to me a couple of months ago, and she is in a space of influence. She's working with a lot of other women and she's lean and athletic. And we did a little case study where she wanted to build strength and she wanted to build some muscle mass through an 8-week period. What was fascinating with her, like we're only talking about a case study of one individual, But she improved all aspects of her performance, like even her, you know, her deadlift improved, her strength went up, her overall performance in the gym. Like she saw huge, like 10-15%, which is all, you know, it's levels that she hadn't hit before. But when we did, we looked at her body composition as well as one of the measures. She didn't increase muscle mass at all. And her body weight, or it was no physical changes except her performance levels went up. And her reflection on it was how critical and how important it is to meet your energy and nutrient needs, and how difficult it is to build that muscle and strength if you're not consuming enough of those key nutrients based on your own needs. So yes, creatine can bring these performance benefits, but if you're looking for those improvements, it just does not work in isolation. And that's the most important message.
Mm, and Daniel, I've been that case study with you. I've walked that path. And that's why it's so important that, as this conversation has been, that we shift our expectations from how we look or what the measurements say to how we feel. And, you know, that was a success for that trainer. What she did was a success. You know, it's not based on muscle alone. Well, thank you very much. As always, the voice of reason. Where can people find you?
Daniel Davey online and davynutrition.com. And thanks, as always, for allowing me to have a really good, balanced conversation on it. And my summary is there exciting developments in creatine? Yes. But there's an awful lot of factors to consider before it's put on the table as an option for you.
Performance nutritionist Daniel Davey, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
At the moment, postnatal care often ends at just 6 weeks. But for many women, that's exactly when the struggle starts. Ailish Gormley is a maternal mental health advocate based in Sligo, and she founded the Year of Care campaign to call for a year-long comprehensive postnatal support system for mothers in Ireland. So how can we build better access to mental health services to help new mums feel less alone? Ailish joins me in studio now. Ailish, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me, Claire.
And as with many campaigns, this began with a personal story. Tell me what happened in your life after your second child.
Yeah, so I'm mum to two wonderful children. I have to get the two names in there. Erla, who's nearly 12, and Kriya, who is nearly 4. I suppose I've had a couple of significant challenges in my journey through parenthood or motherhood so far. When Erla was 7 months old, I became a single parent. So I navigated that journey. And then when Kriya was around 6 months old, I developed postnatal depression. It felt very, it was a feeling that was very foreign to me. I didn't really know what was happening with me. I felt very isolated, very alone. I had a great support network in family and my partner, but I just felt I couldn't talk about it because I didn't fully understand what was going on, and I didn't feel that there were spaces there for me to open up and share, because it can be quite, you know, there's quite a stigma around mental health in general, but mother's mental health, and it can be quite, you know, it can be quite daunting talking about that out loud. So I just didn't feel spaces existed for me to share how I was feeling.
And can you articulate how you were feeling at that time?
Yeah, I suppose I just lost my lust for life, my joy for life. I'm generally a very happy person, very upbeat. And I just noticed kind of this darkness is how I would describe just creeping in, where I just didn't, I couldn't find joy in the things I would normally find joy in, including my children. And the way I sum it up is every day I really just couldn't wait to go to bed at 8 o'clock, 8:30 when the kids were gone to sleep, just to get in, pull the covers up and just be on my own. That was just, that was where I was at. I just felt really lonely and I just didn't have the words to describe how I was feeling. So that was kind of, that's how it felt for me, I suppose. Every day was just about getting to the end of that day.
And I think with anything like that, you start to almost justify it, because obviously you're a busy mum of two. You mentioned personal things going on in your life. Sometimes we're trying to work on top of it. There may be aging parents or other stresses going on. And we start to say, well, maybe this is just parenthood, or maybe this is just life.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head there. Mothers carry so much in general. We're so used to just carrying so many different things, as you say, so many different things, like aging parents and small children and our jobs and everything else. So you just kind of get on with things. And I found that's what I was doing for a very long time, was just kind of pushing through, getting on, until I realized I just can't. I can't push on anymore. I can't, you know, it just kind of came to a head.
And I think that's why it's important for us to say that because yes, life can get tough. Yes, we all have bad days. We all have days where, you know, we feel low energy, low mood, you know, that things are getting on top of us. But it's that flatness, yeah, that no joy in life, and that being consistent is a time, no matter whether this is postnatally or at any time in your life, it's time to reach out for help and support. So who did you turn to first?
So actually, I turned to myself, to be quite honest. To be honest, my story, one evening my son was going to football and it was a dark, miserable evening. And to be honest, I just needed to get out of the house, but I'm not a runner. I wasn't a runner. And I just said, I'm going to throw on the shoes and I'm going to try and just do a bit of running, really just to clear my head. And I ran, and I ran 5K that evening, and I came home and I could feel a small shift in myself. It sounds, you know, it sounds so simple, but I could feel that there was just a little shift in myself. So I do laugh. I do say I was like Forrest Gump. I kept running. I chased that feeling. I realised that movement was key for me. And the more that I ran, the better that I felt, the more that I got out and that movement. And it wasn't until kind of months later, I went to my GP and I told her what had been going on. And I was in a much better place then, but I told her what had been going on. And she said to me, in Welsh, that was postnatal depression, and you were going through a really, she knew kind of about our family life, and she said you were going through a really tough time and you had a small baby and it was postnatal depression. That's what was going on for you. And she said, you know, it sounds like you're doing really well now, but if, you know, if you need to come back at a later stage, do. But she said, just keep doing what you're doing. So that's what I kept doing, and I felt much better.
So when did you begin to think, I need to speak out for other women who may be in my position?
Yeah, so when I came out the other side of it, I started kind of thinking about how lonely I had felt and how I didn't feel that even though I had great support networks, I still didn't feel like I could talk to them about what was going on. And then I started thinking, how many other women feel like this? How many other mothers are feeling like this? So I decided to share my personal story online. I created an Instagram page called Ardu. Ardu is the Irish for Rise. And that was kind of, I wanted to create like a maternal mental health project where I am in Sligo and share my story and let other mothers know that they weren't alone. And I shared my story online, and afterwards I was really apprehensive. I thought, what have I done? You know, I come from a small rural village where everybody knows everybody, and I run a business in that village, and I kind of thought, God, what am I doing? Letting this out, the cat out of the bag, kind of. But after I shared it, I was inundated with messages from people in my own community, messages from Sligo, messages from people further afield, just saying thanks, you know, thanks for sharing your story. I felt like that. And Then I started organising sea swims and walk and talks and running groups, wellness events, all in Sligo, just to bring other mothers together, because what I really wanted to create was that community, that space that I felt was missing. And I seen over and over again, you know, women coming together and talking to each other and sharing stuff, you know, out in the sea, you know, oh, I went through that as well, you know, it was just that light bulb. I just realised, you know, this community, peer support, it's so important when you just don't feel as alone. And so that was 2 years ago now, and we're still going strong. It's amazing. And I've met hundreds of women through that. And I suppose it was meeting hundreds of women and them sharing their stories with me then that made me think, okay, community is great and it's very important, but we need and we deserve more than community alone. We need extra support.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? Because it is one thing, as you say, to have that peer support and to be able to share it openly within your own community. But we need to have the structures in place so that the minute you started feeling that flatness, you were like, I know where I need to go, or I have the public health nurse coming next Tuesday because it's going on beyond the 6 weeks and I'm going to talk to her about it. So tell us what we have now and where some of those gaps exist.
Yeah, so to start with, I suppose it's important to give a little bit of context in terms of, you know, statistics where we're at in Ireland. So Make Mothers Matter, they're an NGO, a European NGO, and they recently conducted a study with close to 10,000 mothers, including Irish mothers. And Irish mothers rank nearly highest in anxiety and burnout in Europe. 77% stated feeling mentally overloaded. That study was just done at the end of 2024. And in Ireland, 15 to 25% of mothers in Ireland experience some form of depression in the first 12 months. But interestingly, the peaks in depression have been observed at 6 and 12 months postpartum. So currently, we have our final checkup is at 6 weeks postpartum. So, you know, we can see that when it's peaking at 6 months and 12 months, that 6 week checkup is no good to all of those women who don't experience anything in the first 6 weeks. I think for a lot of us, any mother will know you're only finding yourself and figuring out who you are in those first 6 weeks. You know, everything is such a blur and such a haze. So to think that care drops off after those 6 weeks, you know, it's just not good enough for many mothers.
And the National Maternity Strategy here in Ireland 10 years ago did a report in which they highlighted gaps here. Has anything changed since then?
Yeah, no. So sadly, so the strategy did suggest that a review should be undertaken to look at the maternity and infant care scheme. So that's the scheme that provides antenatal care and the postnatal care up to 6 weeks. And it was agreed in the strategy that that should be reviewed. It hasn't been reviewed since 1994. But that review was meant to happen, and it's being postponed. It has been postponed a number of times. So really a starting point is that needs to happen. You know, we're 10 years on from the National Maternity Strategy. And, you know, speaking about the National Maternity Strategy, within it as well, you know, the establishment of a mother and baby unit was recommended. And, you know, that's sadly hasn't happened either, which means that mothers who are struggling with their mental health have to be admitted to a psychiatric hospital, and they can't bring their children. And, you know, England has 19 mother and baby units and Scotland has 2. And I just think it's crazy in 2025 that Ireland is still only talking about one. You know, we're still no further into having one.
And I think it's important to point out as well that we keep talking about women and mothers because obviously they're the ones who are physically going through this process and this experience. But this impacts everybody in their life. So this is impacting the children. This is impacting the fathers or the partners involved in this relationship and rippling out. So this doesn't impact just one person. This impacts everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, I think being honest, historically, we don't have a very good track record of looking after women and looking after mothers in this country. You know, when you take the mother and baby homes and the stigma around unmarried mothers and, you know, the marriage bar and, you know, the pressure of traditional gender roles. And a big part of it as well, you know, the underrepresentation of women in Irish politics. And I think that has a lot to do with it because, you know, if decisions are being made without women at the table or without mothers at the table, which is still happening, you know, then the systems don't see mothers and they don't protect them and they don't understand what care looks like without having women and mothers at the table, you know, being a part of those decisions. And, you know, we feel the aftershocks of that today, I think, in our policies, in how underfunded maternal care is, the lack of services, and in how women's health is so often overlooked and deprioritised.
And I do feel very lucky to be a woman in this generation and in this country. But there is still a huge pressure on women in modern society to have it all, to be it all. And especially when you become a mother, it's not a given that you are going to become pregnant. And, you know, we talk about it often on the show here, the fertility struggles people go through. So it can be difficult to put your hand up and say, I'm not coping here. I have everything I have ever wished for and I'm not coping. But it's not that you're not grateful. It's not that you're not happy. This is a medical condition. This is something that can, with support, be overcome. And that's why we need to break down that stigma and normalise this. And it's having those structures in place, like you're saying, the clinics, this is where we go, and it being talked about more and more and more, that will really take the pressure off. So what are you calling for in a year of care?
Yeah, so I suppose the Year of Care campaign is calling for comprehensive year-long postnatal support. That's the main ask. And underneath that, I suppose what we're looking for is, when we're talking about extending postnatal care to a full year, there's many branches off that. So I suppose extending checkups past 6 weeks is the first thing, so that mothers have regular checkups if they wish. They might not wish to, but you know that there is somebody checking in them maybe at 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, that there's mental health screenings and access to physical recovery services from others. And importantly, one full year of paid maternity leave as well. I speak to so many women where the pressure of having to go back to work at 6 months, leave their baby, you know, with a childminder or in a creche because they have a mortgage and, you know, they have financial commitments that they have to go back to work. And that can be a breaking point for many mothers as well, that feeling, you know, at 6 months of having to leave their small baby. So I think that's something really important. Ireland is way behind in terms of other countries, in terms of in European countries, in terms of our maternity leave.
Or childcare that we not that we can trust. I'm not saying there's not brilliant creches and childminders out there, but I was only sitting chatting to somebody at an event this week, and she was saying looking for somebody to mind her son. Her own mother was saying to her, surely there's loads of mothers who aren't working around. And she was like, Mum, there isn't, because we have two income households that are needed because of the price of houses now. There isn't really anybody around. So we have been pushing the government around childcare, because there are women who want to go back to work and then just don't feel they have the support system there. And I loved what you said as well about the physical support, yeah, because in places like France, getting a physio straight after giving birth is essential, because there can be all kinds of physical issues which are continuing, which can have a knock-on effect, yeah, on your mental health. So, I mean, when you start reading it out, you do start to think, why is this not available?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, In terms of other countries and what they do, like when you see, it's very disheartening to see, like, as you say, it's a privilege to live in this country. As you say, as a woman, we're very lucky, but in a lot of ways we're very behind. Like, we're very behind the times in a lot of ways, and I think there's a lot of learning that can be done from looking at other European countries, and looking to the UK as well. You know, I had my son Earl, I had him in the UK, and the difference that I felt, you know, that was nearly 12 years ago, but then having my second child in Ireland, you know, I felt a huge difference in the care that I received. And that's not to say, you know, as you say, we have no more than the creches, we have fantastic services and fantastic midwives and nurses, but it's just the level of care was definitely different. And I think, and another key ask of the campaign then is building community-based support networks. So I think that is key. And as I said, it's not alone, it's not enough. We need real support, and we need real, you know, a system that supports us and cares for us. But community-based support networks are really important for women as well throughout Ireland, because care is patchy. It depends on where you live, the access to services that you have, and financially as well. You know, some people can afford, you know, extra care, extra support, and some people can't, and that it shouldn't be like that.
So where are you at with this, and how can we get behind you?
Yeah, so we had our official launch in Sligo in May of the campaign, and then we're having a Dublin launch at the end of September. There'll be more details on the launch coming on the website and on the social media channels soon, so it'll be great for people to get behind it. At the moment, you know, there's lots of organisations coming in behind it and saying, yeah, this is something we need. Like, even in terms of, I suppose, you know, the year of care is also about protecting vulnerable women, you know, during one of kind of the most high-risk periods of their lives. And we know that domestic violence often begins and escalates after or during pregnancy and after birth. So regular postnatal check-ins, you know, create a real opportunity to spot signs of abuse and offer support and connect women to services, you know, before things escalate. And the same for lone parents who are, you know, often juggling recovery and trauma and isolation on their own. The year of care is another opportunity for them to check in. So yeah, lots of organisations are kind of getting behind it, lots of healthcare providers and women. So you can follow the campaign online on Instagram and Facebook, the Year of Care campaign, and you can also check out the website, is the yearofcare.ie. And I encourage, you know, mothers or anybody that's interested to get in touch with me to share your story. It's a grassroots movement, so I think together is how we build the change and keep working together.
Well, you are some woman for one woman. Thank you for doing what you are. Yearofcare.ie, mental health and maternal advocate Ailish Gormley. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much, Claire.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marisa O'Sullivan. Rory Galvin was on podcasts, and Hugo da Silva Scott was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.